I'd like to welcome our second speaker, Jen Scatterbowl. Dr. Scatterbowl is a research fellow at the Social Policy Research Centre at the University of New South Wales. She conducts policy-relevant research related to the lives of children, young people and their families. In 2008, Jen was awarded a Krizik Foundation Scholarship to investigate leadership challenges in integrated service provision. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks. This paper, Vagrants and Cartographers, elucidates barriers to educational equality through an account of the lived experiences of two young Indigenous women, Toss and Willa. These two had experiences in both mainstream schooling and in an alternative education program that was aimed to address early school leaving. They lived in an area of socioeconomic mix and were schooled with more advantaged peers. The policy thinking is that mixing advantage with disadvantage is the way to raise attainment because horizons are broadened and educational capital is transferred from the privileged to the less privileged. However, Toss and Willa's story suggests that school structures designed to attract and retain middle-class students presented barriers to their learning and segregated them from their better-off counterparts. This paper traces the policies, schooling structures and processes that discourages the transfer of advantages and ultimately undermined equity. These young people's location on the periphery of the education system is connected to the sorting and shifting of a marketised system and worsened by localisation agendas and the demise of comprehensive equity programs. Their story gestures towards the promises and challenges of progressive education. In their own words, Toss and Willa didn't get out much. That is, they rarely got out of the neighbourhood. Toss had been on one trip away from home. Her family drove halfway across two states to the mission country where her father was raised. Once there, she spent most of her time in the car, shocked by the living conditions and desperately wanting to go home. Willa didn't like to talk about anything to do with home and was non-committal and silent when asked. She liked to make out that she was an entirely solo traveller. Their lives may not have been punctuated with the activities or holidays that are customary for young Australians, but they had know-how beyond their years. These two were quick to understand what they were being asked, quick to rebuff an intrusion. And if anyone transgressed their hard-won boundaries, they were quick to turn their backs and give what five-year-olds call the rude finger. In other ways, they were slow to make and keep an appointment for an interview, slow to believe an adult might want to hear their views, and slow to point out that the solo Willa had a sidekick who was a young woman from the neighbourhood who was being constantly bullied at school. Indigenous young people are not well served by education, as we've seen over and over again today, in part because the Australian education system is characterised by high performance but only by average equity. In the graph that's up here now, performance is the vertical axis and equity the horizontal, where to the left on the equity side. More than most other countries, our system promotes parent choice about schools. In an era of rapid change, uncertainty and dissolving social structures, an era Bowman calls liquid modernity, heightened parenting anxiety pushes middle-class parents to place their children with other well-to-do students. The scramble for ever more advantage inflames competition and residualises students from economically disadvantaged backgrounds. Outcomes from the OECD's PISA test assessments indicate that 60% of these young people are schooled together and consistently achieve lower results than their better-off counterparts. This leaves approximately 40% of disadvantaged students scattered throughout mixed SES or specialist schools. The statistics on Year 12 attainment specific to Indigenous students are a particularly sharp snapshot of educational inequality in Australia. In 2008, only 46.5% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students continued schooling through to Year 12, compared with 75.6% of their non-Indigenous peers. While government investment's narrowing the gap, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students are still much less likely to succeed. So this paper explores those lived experiences through qualitative data from disadvantaged students that while they were in an alternative education program. Briefly, the program was set up by departments of education, housing, police and NGO stakeholders as an annex to a large multi-campus secondary school. Its aims, as I said before, were to address chronic early school leaving in the economically disadvantaged local Indigenous community. The study involved several waves of semi-structured interviews with principals and teachers, NGO youth workers, community members, young people who from the community served as advisors, and the students themselves. The students were used photographs of their time in the program as prompts for discussion. And the next section sketches out the complexity of homeschool relations for these kids, as told by various stakeholders. Students in the annex came from families who over generations had endured many policy injuries and injustices, policy failures across education, health, family services, policing and Aboriginal affairs portfolios. As young people, many students had care responsibility for siblings and sometimes for parents. They expended considerable energy managing the family's image in the local community. They wanted to ward off the stigma that pathologises their families and labelled them as dysfunctional. Tensions flared when family business was exposed, so for these kids, remaining under the radar was paramount. The mainstream school was a difficult space for these kids when there was trouble at home. The processes designed to support disadvantaged students hyped up the visibility of family stress. Students were expected to explain absences, latenesses, and difficult moods, yet telling a teacher was fraught because teachers passed information on. And as Toss said, soon everyone knows. In addition, their families had little confidence in the educational system for their children. They wanted them to do well at school, but felt their knowledge and their struggles weren't recognised in schools. Over years, the neighbourhood school had marshalled a fragile confidence and sense of ownership amongst the locals. These locals knew people who worked there and they knew people who'd succeeded there in the past. However, changes in structure in the late 90s undermined this identification. The small local school was amalgamated into a super school that drew enrolments from six or more suburbs, creating a bigger and higher achieving student population. The super school's multi-campuses were age-streamed rather than place-based. For local social housing residents, this undermined the fragile confidence they had that their children could benefit in the structure. So in the context of these homeschool relations, Toss and Willa struggled with attendance and with learning. They felt ambivalent towards school. When their friends were present, it was good and they went, and when they weren't, it was difficult. Their disciplinary knowledges were patchy. They struggled with content that other students found easy. The problem wasn't learning difficulties. It was that the school presumed students have a standard knowledge base on which curriculum can be built. It also delivered content as if there was continuity of learning for all students. At 15, Toss understood what might be considered very complex texts. She was well rehearsed in the persuasive language of the Mabo judgment. She said, "I get taught that stuff every day. My mum just drills it into my head." Her skills in persuasive language, however, were lost in assessment tasks. She didn't understand the term persuasive writing, so she didn't attempt to answer any of the questions in the NAPLAN test. For these kids, the content they knew was rarely connected to the content at school, and in front of their classmates, they covered up failures with shows of bravado. Non-attendance and bravado brought them into conflict with teachers. They were treated as behaviour problems and often sent from the classroom before they even sat down. Teachers knew the responsibilities they were managing at home, but they felt like they were treated as dumb black kids. They were the vagrants of the school, constantly being moved on to become someone else's responsibility. They found it hard to pick up or use resources in this system of so-called universal provision. The super school offered wide subject choices and opportunities to mix with high-achieving students. However, the subjects, pedagogies and kids available to our participants was narrow because of top-up fees and presumed knowledge. Subjects grounded in rich task learning, which contextualises and operationalises content, and by the way, which is favoured in elite schools and high ability streams, typically attract fees in public schools. The school had a subsidy system, but our participants felt like asking for subsidies marked them as poverty blacks, and it stirred up trouble. Cost wasn't the only barrier, At other times, they deliberately missed rich learning experiences like excursions because they felt no connection to the destinations chosen by schools. They felt shown up when other students could talk about alignments between the places they went and their home experiences. So this super school context of expanded subject choice didn't actually broaden options for Willa and Toss. They selected from the same narrow range of subjects that would have been available to them in a residualised school. Nonetheless, the school was proactive in addressing non-attendance and disengagement, and it worked with elders and community organisations to set up a special learning program off-site. This educational annex was in a building on the High Street. It wasn't a place of status in the eyes of local kids. Willa said, "Who'd want to go to school in a youthy except for a bunch of black kids?" While stigmatised, the annex provided space for them to breathe. It was a hiatus in a trajectory of increasing educational failure. They could arrive and leave when they liked, get a feed, participate or not, depending on their mood and energy levels. They could find their friends. The pedagogy was relationship and care-based, and when they wanted to learn, there was rich task learning that allowed their existing knowledge to bloom and teachers ready to walk them through the things they didn't understand and to scaffold the steps they'd missed. Within this space, many began attending and participating in learning. They also began to get out more. Journeys and trips from family homes and local schools progressively stretch out the known world, enabling young people to chart new territories. Getting out provided a base for rich curriculum which bridges the abstract with concrete lived experience. Outings grew from classroom discussions. They were a long time in the making, small in scale, student-driven and organised. Once choosing their own destinations, they selected places that aligned to their own knowledges. They became cartographers, charting and controlling their own learning journeys. In all their talk with me about learning, there was one event that really generated a lot of affect. It was different from excursions they'd missed in the past. It was a camp. Toss said, "This time we wanted to go because we were all together. We're the people that we know and that we hang around with, so yeah, we all wanted to go." The presence of others who understood their struggles muted the burden of visibility they felt at school and made a critical difference to their desires to participate in the unfamiliar. They enjoyed the planning. These kids carried large amounts of responsibility in their homes but had no resources to organise activities. So for them, making budgets, requesting authorisations, timetables and permissions were approached with relish. Their chosen destination was an island that had once housed a psychiatric hospital. Societies have long cast out their difficult populations to the wasted space of small islands and peninsulas, close enough to valued land to be surveilled, but far enough away to prevent contagion. Major cities typically have outlying, isolated island-like spaces once occupied by quarantine stations, mental asylums, missions, and so on. Many Aboriginal people have some connection to these lands, lands that are imbued with cautionary tales about the consequences of being deemed useless or troubling to a functioning citizenry. The students in the annex had chosen the site because more than one had a family member who'd been housed in the psychiatric ward, and perhaps it was also a trope for their own current exclusions. These shy kids became highly animated when they were looking at photographs of the camp. Their downcast eyes and single-sentence answers gave way to peals of giggles, kids tripping over their words, teasing and lots of swearing. They told of fear and excitement when they first landed on the island, spirits rising. They explored its boundaries in the dark. They were loud in their attempts at silence, abrim with silliness. They raced around seeking the known, trying to connect to each other, through Facebook, of course. "Yeah," they said, says Toss, "we're trying to find a signal on the island. It was just the most devastating thing about it. When you found a signal, you had to stand in one spot." "Yeah," and Willa jumps in, "Willa, like you were standing there, don't touch me, don't touch me, don't move. I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing." Toss says, "And then you lose it." So they sought out the known in this unknown landscape and they played at being prisoners, convicts and conquerors. Willa eventually said, "We ran that island, bro. The teachers couldn't find us for ages." Willa says, "We're like, quick, 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 some of us on the floor, me and Toss. It was our idea, right? We made that." And then Toss explains, "Because we were all like kid brain." Their victorious claims, "We ran that island. It was our idea, right? We made that." communicate the ownership and joy of controlling their own knowledge acquisition. They explained their frenzy as a return to a carefree childlike state, which they felicitously name as kid brain. The heightened emotions that underlie the experience speak to the engagement of these students. They knew the achievements were significant, not just in terms of their organisation, but also in terms of taking risks to do and learn something new. This heightened experience was important in turning around their sense of themselves as failed learners. From this point, Toss and Willa decided to continue with their studies. They wanted credentials with power rather than the low-level certificates available through TAFEs and RTOs, so they returned to the mainstream campus. It was a difficult transition because the structures, processes and pedagogy that failed them in the past hadn't changed. The school structure was hollowed out and it's missing several rings that should scaffold the pedagogies and processes in the annex with those in conventional classrooms. Time will tell if the things they learnt in the annex are enough for them to continue as cartographers for their own learning, or whether the same barriers will return them to the position of vagrants amongst their middle class counterparts. State government and school accountabilities in terms of disadvantaged students are currently framed in terms of the provision of places, narrowing gaps in achievement, and working with NGOs, businesses, and so on to provide case management and other services. This is a really different commitment to raising the attainment of the lowest rung. Provision of places in education, training, and work under the Compact for Young Australians doesn't ensure that these exit pathways from education lead out of disadvantage. When policy initiatives are linked to attendance are combined with those linked to narrowing attainment gaps, the system is oriented towards a triage approach. Here, students with the most difficult lives are shunted into holding bays in the form of low ability streams, behaviour units, and other specialised annexes. As today's narrative shows, special programs are not always poor quality, but many can be, and many are a treadmill of poor quality courses into precarious work or early parenthood. Indeed, unless the structures and processes of mainstream school can be made more responsive to disadvantaged students generally, many good quality special programs will still end up with students on those treadmills. Outsourcing care for disadvantaged students through case management brings in necessary resources from other portfolios. However, it can also undercut imperatives to change structures and processes towards the educational principles that worked for Toss and Willa, namely environments where learning is holistic and relationship-based, and where disciplinary knowledge is best thought of as best co-constructed through students' own knowledge and experience. Localisation approaches to funding and policy compounds many of these barriers as it holds schools responsible for delivering all this and more on very uneven playing fields created by overarching federal policies and supranational forces. So since the mid-1980s, federal, Labor and coalition governments have both supported the principle that competition produced by parent choice makes the most efficient and effective schools. The dezoning of public school catchment areas enabled public schools to specialise and thus discriminate in favour of high-achieving students. This produced a drift where middle-class families with strong educational capital clustered together in private or selective school sectors, leaving families with the lowest resources and highest needs concentrated in residualised schools. These schools are hard to staff, hard to teach in, hard to learn in. In an effort to address the drift, education departments have amalgamated many such schools. Large schools should mean expanded subject choice and increased ability to cater to different students, but as Toss and Willa's experiences show, subject choice is mediated by considerations other than availability. Importantly, expanded subject choice is not all that middle-class families are looking for. They want homogeneous classes with high-achieving students. Ability streaming inside schools with heterogeneous populations gives those schools a market edge, but prohibits the flow and mixing of different forms of cultural capital. Toss and Willa weren't benefiting from rubbing shoulders with their better-off counterparts, and their better-off counterparts weren't benefiting from them. Curriculum has been narrowed more recently because of NAPLAN results. It's exacerbated by the publication of these results. In contrast to earlier diagnostic tests like basic skills tests, NAPLAN results are most commonly used at a whole of school level, and their publication affects the numbers and types of students coming into a school. Many teachers feel pressured to teach to the tests, and money earmarked for disadvantaged students is spent on training tests with students, with low literacy and numeracy levels to be test ready. Test ready is important, but it's not enough to turn around students who haven't yet found the richness of literacy and numeracy as ways of representing the world and meanings within it. The narrowing of curriculum to match test content most strongly affects students like Toss and Willa, whose family knowledges are not reflected in the tests. Young people from high poverty contexts need curriculum and pedagogy that draws on the funds of knowledge in their families and so maximises the traction of their existing knowledge base. This is specialist teaching, as it's specialist leadership that's also needed to manage the intricate social dynamics between rich and poor students. Localisation agendas encapsulated in current policy like the COAG Local Schools Local Decisions Agreement mean that schools are supported to address problems with other local schools, services and businesses. Under the rubric of increased autonomy, their schools are meant to overcome the competition between them that's produced by Commonwealth funding and policy arrangements. Systemic, cohesive research agendas once contained in federal programs like the long-standing Disadvantaged Schools Program are now fragmented and hollowed out by devolved systems based in audit and incentivised governance systems. The task for the principal at Toss and Willa School is daunting. How to restructure learning in the mainstream school to create a responsive learning environment for disadvantaged students and still attract high-achieving students whose families are seeking homogeneous advantages. Short-term funding frames, small budgets distributed across local schools make it difficult for those on the ground to marshal together the resources needed for the kind of research and programs required to overcome complex disadvantages, let alone to do so in a marketised education field. Charting our progress in educational attainment as a nation could be a strong driver for equality. We know from PISA results that some countries perform, such as Hong Kong, Finland and Canada, perform higher than Australia and are more egalitarian. Those countries do well in both performance and equity, but they don't encourage schools to compete for enrolments. Some of the most recent work by Jane Kenway shows that Australia, in fact, leads the way in putting our government money into advantaged kids. These data suggest that as a nation, we could invest far more heavily in education that serves disadvantaged students and still reap the benefits. And I think, as Wilkinson and Pickett claim, if a nation desires higher levels of achievement amongst all students, it must address the underlying inequalities which create a steeper social gradient in educational attainment. Thank you.
Have any questions?
My name is John Smythe from the University of Ballarat. Thanks for a very inspiring but very depressing discussion there. And my question really is, given where you finished up here, where you've pointed out the fact that we have one of the most inequitable social gradients in terms of educational achievement, and given that kids like Willa and Toss seem to actually get this and get it fairly quickly, what is it that's holding back the policy class from actually getting it?
What is it
that's holding back the policy class from actually getting it, that these processes actually work? Why do we continue to use policies that demonstrably fail, as is happening in Finland at the moment? One of the most egalitarian systems in the world produces some of the highest results, and yet they're now mandating curriculum at year 9 through to year 12 against their own success rates. My question is, what's wrong with the policy class? They don't seem to understand these things.
I can't quite answer that question. I think it is a question of political will. And I think in the same way that Fran was talking about regulation and how you put your arguments forward, we need to be better at putting arguments forward as to why raising the bottom actually makes a difference to the whole. The other thing I think is that there's a lot of a huge amount of restructuring would be needed actually to make schools welcoming and productive places for young people who are highly disadvantaged. I think there's lots of possibilities, and I know some of your work and lots of educational researchers have talked about how you might do things like have mixed ability grouping, how you might draw on funds of knowledge that young people have from home. And I think that Willa's passion for the Mabo judgment is a perfect example of the kind of knowledge from home that you might use with young people in schools that actually everyone can benefit from. Advantaged students would benefit enormously from understanding the conditions that create things like the Mabo judgment, how it works, how political will was rallied around it. But in doing that, what you start, or maybe really positively, not but, and when you do that, I think what you start to change is the concept of education that allows us to accumulate wealth and accumulate power to consume and actually be more focused on the common good. And that would be a very positive step for Australian schools.
John Altman from the ANU. Thanks very much for your focus on an Indigenous case, which obviously is in some ways the most intractable educational equity issue that we face. In these discussions on education, I often find that we conflate issues of attendance, curriculum, learning environment, and then measuring outcomes. And it seems to me that we have very partial sort of, foci on each of those issues. In Australia, the predominant view at the moment seems to be that if you get the attendance right, everything else will follow. And I guess the question I have for you is whether you have any comment on the school enrolment and attendance measures that are proposed, the first came in as part of the Northern Territory intervention and have continued, where parents who don't get their kids to attend school lose their welfare payments.
It's a little bit about punishing people who are already been punished. I think that the focus on school attendance is totally ridiculous. I think that what matters is the quality of the spaces that children attend, not that they just attend any old thing. And I think because the longer you're in something that doesn't work for you, the less faith you have in it. So forcing children or young people like Toss and Willa to go to school when it doesn't work for them is far more likely to turn them off other education possibilities later. So I think we need to, our interventions need to be across the whole of school system so that classrooms everywhere are safe and interesting places for kids that they want to go to. There's a huge amount of work to be done in that, but there's also a huge amount of money that is distributed in Australia to private schools, selective schools, that could be rerouted to actually create that whole of system kind of change.
Steffi Hamerite-Donald from UNSW. Thank you very much for that talk. It's very sobering. I want to just ask a couple of questions. One about the Aboriginal hostels system in New South Wales and what your views are on that in terms of internal migration and young people then being living together but attending attending schools a long way from home, and what your observations on that process is. And the second comment is around systems like the higher school certificate, where scaling occurs within schools, so there's a certain democratization of achievement within a particular school, that if in a cohort everyone does well, everyone does weller, but it's not democratized across the whole system. It's very competitive between different schools and different types of schools, and I was wondering if you again had any comments on how that might be the idea is quite a nice idea, how might it be made actually socially
cohesive? I actually can't comment on Aboriginal hostels. These two kids lived locally. So I won't try. And in terms of there are definitely schools that don't focus on individual achievement. Some of the more high achieving public schools have a cohort approach to student outcomes. They frame their arguments in terms of attracting families around sort of 21st century skills, that you have to work in teams, that you need to be responsive and able to build knowledge from research. So I think that there's definitely arguments that can be made to debunk and disrupt the idea that high ability streaming is the only way for students to do well. So I think there's arguments out there. The problem is that the most recent moves in Commonwealth policy, I think, actually makes it harder for schools to pull together resources to make those arguments and to sort of debunk the competition style. It's becoming increasingly fragmented.